Solve, secure, protect. Look to Patel for the independent thinking and cross-disciplinary focus it takes to advance security and safety in a changing world. They provide their clients with integrated solutions that secure our nation and help solve challenges within infrastructure, environment, emerging threats, and deployable mission-ready technology. Their teams leverage their deep expertise to develop science and technology for a healthier, safer, and more sustainable world. Visit Patel.org to learn how Patel makes the impossible possible. Welcome to From the Crow's Nest, a podcast on electromagnetic spectrum operations, or EMSO. I'm your host, Ken Miller, Director of Advocacy and Outreach for the Association of Old Crows. Thanks for listening. In this episode of From the Crow's Nest, I welcome back our guest and good friend, retired U.S. Air Force Colonel Jeff Fisher. He is a longtime aviator, an EW officer, served with EC-130 compass calls as well as EA-6B prowlers. During his time in the military, he also was a diplomatic defense official to U.S. embassies in Austria and Kosovo and at NATO Special Operations Headquarters. Today, he is retired, but he is a military fiction author working on his fourth book, and I highly encourage our listeners to pick them up. With that, I'd like to welcome my guest, Colonel Fisher. It's great to have you on From the Crow's Nest. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, I wanted to have you back on the show. We had you on a few months ago talking about, you know, about Ukraine and Russia and what was going on. That was about 4 months ago, 5 months ago now. We're at about the 7 month point in time. So I thought it'd be good to have you back on, just talk a little bit about more about what we're seeing over there. A lot of activity going on, you know, with recent arms transfers and sales over of U.S. weapons over to Ukraine. That has implications. And of course, a lot of that touches on our area of specialty, which is electromagnetic warfare and EMS superiority. So I wanted to bring your thoughts in on that. You know, as our listeners know, you have a long career as an EW officer and you are over near that area. So you're watching it very closely, what's going on. And so I thank you for being on the show again today. So just to get started, you know, recent reports have suggested that Russia seems to be reallocating some troops from southeastern portion, maybe to the south, to reinforce some of its offensives down there. Ukraine might be doing some counteroffensives or trying to exploit that reallocation of troops in the southeast region. What can you tell us, you know, about what you're seeing recently about some of that troop movement, and what does it mean for kind of the overall trends of the conflict over there?
Yeah. So, Ken, these are great questions. You know, I'm currently writing my fourth book, and I've been doing a lot of research. The fourth book that I'm on right now is called The Russian Puppeteer, and it actually is a fiction novel based loosely on the actual war in Ukraine. So your questions couldn't be more timely. Kharkiv is where the big fighting is. That's what is in all the news over here in Europe right now. And what I find fascinating is in that the research that I've done for my book, we all in the United States have kind of talked about the electromagnetic spectrum and the electronic warfare in Ukraine as being significant. And there is a lot of stuff. But what I'm starting to learn is that without, and I'll use the term electromagnetic spectrum superiority, as well as air superiority, the battle space in Ukraine is very, very different than what the United States has experienced going back through Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's starting to display itself in other ways and in other battle space domains or battle spaces, if you will. An example of this is what you do not see in Ukraine is you do not see heavy lift like C-17s and C-130s resupplying forward lines. And the reason is because without the ability to do electronic warfare and take out S-300s and S-400s and have air superiority in conjunction with that EW, you haven't contested airspace and you're not able to bring them in. I had a fascinating discussion with an Army colonel who just took over command of an interesting medical unit. He's now the commander of the United States Army Research Institute of Environmental Medicine. And we had a great talk last night because we were talking about Ukraine. And he said, what the medical field is realizing is without the ability to get rotary wing in to pick up wounded service members, that golden hour is extending. And Ukraine is not enjoying the, you know, the survival rates that the United States did in Afghanistan or in Iraq. And this all goes back to electronic warfare, right? If you have good electronic warfare and a good electronic, good air superiority, you have the ability to get in and get rotary wing and utilize your other domains, air, land, and sea. We were able to do that in Kosovo, which is a perfect example, right? Prowlers and Compass Call and other assets were able to dominate the electromagnetic spectrum and take out the SA-6s, to take out the other surface-to-air missile systems. In Iraq, we're able to take out the SA-2s, SA-3s, SA-6s. Ukraine presented different challenges. It wasn't air defense. It was counter-RCID, but we were eventually able to do that. I read in the news, actually, just before we talked, came out today that the Ukrainians on their counteroffensive have actually captured a couple pieces of Russian EW gear. I had not heard of them before. They were called RP-377 UVMILs. And I went to look it up, and it's basically Russia's equivalent or similar things to our counter RCID systems that would travel around on vehicles or in convoys to actually stop, you know, detonations of IEDs. The pictures that were posted were not full systems. They were just, it almost looked like just the amplifier boxes and stuff like that. I don't know if they have the full system, but I found that also intriguing that Russians would leave these types of assets behind as they were being overrun. So I think that kind of gets a little bit to the meat of your first question. I don't know where else you want me to go with that.
So I want to talk a little bit about what you just talked about, you know, some of the equipment that's left behind or that's being captured during the counteroffensive. But you mentioned the Kharkiv region is really heating up. Looking at it from a geopolitical standpoint, what is Russia trying to accomplish? I mean, I'm looking at a map here, a recent map of controlled territories and so forth. And, you know, it's clear that they have quite a strong presence, obviously, in the south and southeast, where it kind of blocks Ukraine from the Black Sea. So is there a access to the Black Sea and the Sea of or other waterways in that region? Is that part of what's driving that position? And how what does that mean in terms of long-term, what, you know, strategic victory for Russia or Ukraine?
I think trying to get inside Vladimir Putin's head and to understand exactly what his strategy is a foolish man's game. But I'm willing to play because I've often been called a foolish man. We all know this. He started out from the north and kind of tried to push into the capital and, you know, cut off the head, and he didn't do very well at that. So then, you know, then the south, he'd been for a long time in Crimea since 2014. And then, you know, when you look at the oblasts down in the southeast, he'd been there as well for quite some time. The most recent offenses and looking at Kharkiv, I think that it's far easier for him to logistically support that push than the push up from the north, because he had to use Belarus as a staging point. And I think that became politically tenuous and also logistically a challenge. His navy has definitely not performed as well as he had hoped. So you're not seeing those pushes into Odessa and things like that. So I think what he's tried to do is simplify his battle space, right? Shorten those lines of logistics. The southeastern front of Ukraine, the western front of Russia, is the front that is easiest for him to resource. I would tell you, though, if you wanted to talk geopolitics a little bit, Europeans are starting to become very, very concerned about the winter and what the cost of oil and the availability of oil and energy is going to be. And Vladimir Putin's long been known to want to always play a long game. He, ever since the wall fell in the 1990s, he's been into Transnistria in Moldova. He went to Nagorno-Karabakh between Azerbaijan and Armenia. He's got forces that have gone into Georgia, right, and South Ossetia and Abkhazia, and they just sit there, and he's just willing to wait things out. The same thing can be said for Kosovo and Serbia, right? You know, he's promised Serbia for years, to include President Vucic, that eventually Serbia will again own Kosovo. It's just a matter of time. After the 23rd year now that NATO's been there, NATO's getting tired, and NATO will leave. And as soon as they leave, the plan is to go in and take it. So I think he's willing to play a long game and force other nations to stop their support of Ukraine.
You speak of the long game, obviously, with, you know, our removal of presence from Afghanistan last year. And, you know, we're not necessarily, you know, from a political standpoint, ready to maybe take on another long game. And you're looking at some of the, you know, the way that U.S. has supported Ukrainians against Russia, and particularly with, I think we're up to about $12 billion now in weapons purchases or weapons transfers. you know, how long do you see this going on, and at what level of support can U.S. sustain in its help with Ukraine? I mean, $12 billion obviously sounds like a lot. I think in the grand scheme, it's not that much. There's room to grow in that, but certainly there's going to be a saturation point where it's like enough. We're not seeing the progress. So where do you see kind of the recent arms sales purchases? Where do you see these going, and are they having an effect or a positive effect on the conflict over there?
When you hear about the effects of the ground-to-ground based missile systems, the Ukrainians like them. You know, logistics isn't about a start point and an end point. It's about a process. I think the biggest problem that we have is not how much we're giving, but the size of the pipe to push the equipment through. We do pretty well at getting equipment across the ocean. We can get it into Ramstein pretty easily, or other locations where we have large depots and large systems. But from there, you're starting to see a little bit of a bottleneck, I think it's only going to get worse. I think the bottleneck is going to be a problem. We can even get the stuff into Warsaw, but the nearest airfield that's actually viable to use to get stuff into Ukraine is an airport called Rezevov, which is down near the border. And from Rezevov, and I hope I'm saying that correctly, I'll pronounce it because I'm not the best. It's R-Z-E-S-Z-O-W, Rezevzow, okay? Forgive me for my Polish. But that location to get all the way to the eastern part of Ukraine is a 10-hour drive, right? On roads that were not intended. You know, it's not a four-lane highway all the way across Ukraine. So there's your bottleneck. And along that 10-hour problem, you're complicated by numerous checkpoints as well, because you're in a battle space where Ukrainians and Russians look very similar. They have very, very similar languages. They both know how to speak each other's language. So at any given time, anyone traveling down the road can be a good guy or a bad guy. So you have a lot of checkpoints, slowing down the logistics process even further. So I wish the United States would give more, but I wouldn't necessarily say that the problem lies in Congress or the politicians for not pushing enough forward. There are other challenges in the logistics trail that need to be addressed.
Hello, everyone. I want to take a short break to thank Battelle for their continued support for our From the Crow's Nest podcast. It's always great to hear from them, and I am pleased to be here with Rusty Colemorgan, Navy veteran and division manager at Battelle. Rusty, thanks for joining me here on From the Crow's Nest. It's great to have you on the show.
Hey, thanks very much, and thanks for the opportunity.
You've had an interesting career with extensive stints in the Navy and industry. What brought you to Battelle, and how does your experience align with Battelle's mission?
Yeah, thanks for that, Ken. And I did have a very rewarding career as a Navy pilot. And as I transitioned through a number of companies in industry, I continued to have great experiences because I got the chance to work alongside eye-watering technical talent. What I'm most excited about at Battelle is how our campus is literally surrounded by an impressive depth of relevant applied researchers. That uniquely embedded in-house research capability serves as a foundation as we focus on solutions to the world's hardest problems. We strive to create a better world through science, and the RavenStar technology is the latest example of a hard problem with wide society benefits.
In the past, we've heard here on From the Crow's Nest from your colleagues, Doug Thornton and Molly Engel. They provided some intriguing insights about the RavenStar antenna. And can you tell our listeners a little bit about the challenges of this trade space and what you're trying to address with this game-changing technology?
The bottom line is that users have had to sub-optimize their capabilities and needs with traditional design approaches in the RF spectrum. Traditionally, electronic warfare and command and control users want a number of capabilities that create a challenging design space. Those needs are typically long ranges, maximum throughput, and low probability of intercept, low probability of detection. They want those ranges for more effective operational reach or standoff, and they want more throughput for the increased data that leads to actionable intelligence. And those tight control of the emissions, they want those for either maximizing energy on a particular bearing or limiting the ability to detect or interfere with their emissions. It's not an easy trade space, but the flexibility of the RavenStar architecture gives them more of what they want operationally.
So what does the RavenStar do that makes it optimized across these critical performance needs, and how does that stand out from traditional approaches?
Well, our frequency agility gives operators flexibility to work an ultra-wide portion of the spectrum through a single low-swap software-defined aperture. RavenStar co-designed extremely wide-band aperture arrays with co-located advanced electronics. And this allows a compact, frequency-flexible RF solution. Our approach minimizes conventional antenna feature trade-off and allows significant design flexibility for delivering the spectrum dominance that's needed.
We've been tracking this program here on the show. How mature is RavenStar today?
We put it at a TRL 6 after testing that we've done in December of 2023, and continuing into this year, we'll do field tests, accompany lab demonstrations, and development performance on formal efforts with different DoD customers, all that are pointed toward a continued maturation of the RavenStar design. They show the RavenStar's ability is to support all domain missions that require multiple communications.
Well, thank you, Rusty, for joining me here on the show. It's always great to hear from the Patel team. And now it's time to get back to our show. When looking at some of the recent purchases or transfers, you're seeing kind of an uptick. I know that in August, there was some more UAVs. There were some HARM missiles included in a package. And then more recently, there's some very highly accurate GPS-guided shells or artillery systems that are sent over. It seems to be almost a bit of a ramp up in some of the precision-guided munitions and some of the EW, electromagnetic spectrum, EMSO types of capabilities. What are you seeing in terms of the trends and what we're sending over now versus earlier in the conflict?
Yeah, so the HARM missile is fascinating, right? As a guy who shot, practiced and was trained on HARM and shot HARM in combat, my HARM was integrated into the AOQ-99 system on an EA-6B, making it probably the most lethal and most capable HARM, not from a missile perspective, but feeding information and identifying targets and controlled by guys who understand electronic warfare. Slapping an AGM-80, now congratulations to the engineers, this is awesome, right? But basically slapping an AGM-88 onto a MiG-type aircraft, I can't imagine that you're going to be able to use too many sensors from that MiG, and you're most likely going to have to rely on the emitter libraries that exist inside the HARM missile's own core library of emitters. It's not necessarily bad. It's not the most effective use of a HARM, I can promise you that. But there are times, even in tactics in the United States, where we would preemptively shoot a HARM, and the intent was to actually force that SAM operator on the other end to make a decision. The missile's inbound. Do you wish to leave your radar on and take a chance, or do you wish to turn it off? They'll need a lot of HARM missiles if they want, to gain some kind of air supremacy or air superiority. But I like it from a fact of, I honestly believe that Russian surface air missile system operators have kind of operated with impunity up until now. Forcing them to make some decisions and turn off at certain times is a good thing. And it's starting to win back a little bit of that spectrum warfare that's awesome. I read also in an article today that, the Ukrainians are taking some pretty significant hits and damage in and around Kharkiv. In the electronic warfare realm, one of the things that some of the soldiers have reported, and I'll share the article with you here in a little bit, was that they're using basically commercial-grade UAVs, and as they're taking them off, Russian soldiers are basically capturing them through the electronic spectrum and then flying them across the border and then eventually turning and using them against the Ukrainians. So the Ukrainians don't have any kind of encryption system on their UAVs. They're not military grade. So they're having challenges there. There's a good and a bad example for you for both Ukraine and Russia.
So in talking about the EW systems that are going over, particularly the HARM, they're not fully integrated. Does the use of the HARM change the risk equation for Russian forces?
Sure. I think there's going to be a lot to learn at how these operate. I mean, to be fair, there's going to be some operators who watch them come in and imagine that they're not necessarily tracking on them and they're going to die, right? So that's a lesson learned. There's other guys who are going to turn them off after they start learning some of their friends die and they won't necessarily turn on. There's a lot of different tactics that you can use with preemptive shots. You can shoot multiple preemptive shots over a span of, let's say, 5, 10, 15 minutes. And for a short period of time, you can buy, right? Because you just spent 10 missiles, you can buy a window of the electromagnetic spectrum and by definition, because they're HARMs, air superiority for a short amount of time. If that's enough time for you to get a couple fighters or bombers into a given area and strike a key target, that's a financial choice. Is it worth it to spend that precious resource? Because I don't think Ukraine's to the point where they have unlimited HARMs yet, but you'd learn from that as well. How willing is Russia to fight through that HARM missile system. If we keep doing it, are they going to build a counter to preemptive targeting? I don't know.
And that gets to the next question. What is the potential downside of this?
I think Russia knows everything that they need to know about HARMs, right? We shot them off of F-4G while Weasel's back in Desert Storm. Not me personally, but the United States. They know the missile profile. They know the missile characteristics. I'd be shocked if they were surprised. And to be fair, you know, the United States has gone through a requirements process and is upgrading. Last I knew, they were upgrading the HARM to either a future version or another missile called AARGM, which was another advanced version. Russia will do everything it can to learn the capabilities of that missile as soon as possible. And getting rid of these HARMs, I don't think there's going to be much that Russia will learn. They will learn about their capabilities against the S-300 and S-400, which until recently, I don't think we've been shooting at them. But again, it's a limited capability, right? Because you're only using the emitter libraries located within the missile. It's not integrated into the system. So I think it would be foolhardy on the Russians' part to actually just say, hey, we understand HARMs against S-300s and 400s because they were shot at us. Doesn't matter if it's coming from an F-18G or an F-16 CJ. It's the same thing as a MiG-29. That would probably be a very bad mistake to make.
One of the things that we talked about, and you raised it in your earlier answer, is there's oftentimes cascading effects when you have or don't have EMS superiority. And some of those effects are not usually always seen, you know, in terms of medical evacuations and hospital operations and so forth that are a result of either having or not having EMS superiority. So when you look at Ukraine, you know, where are we at on being able to achieve, or where are they at on being able to achieve EMS superiority? What are we learning about our ability to either attain that or help our allies attain that in conflict?
Yeah, I think fixing the battle space in Ukraine to get it to where we would probably want it to be is going to take years. And I think many of us would hope and pray that this does not become a years-long war. But, you know, it's disappointing to learn many lessons that we continually learn over and over again in militaries. In 2016 to 2018, I was the defense attaché assigned in Kosovo. And at the time, the USERA commander was a gentleman by the name of Lieutenant General Ben Hodges. And Ben Hodges, who rightly or wrongly, was frustrated at the ability to move military, ground-based military equipment around Europe. If you recall, you know, just prior to 2014, before the big Crimea invasion, we'd gotten rid of all heavy tanks and heavy assets in Ukraine. And 2014 hits, and all of a sudden, Ben Hodges, as the USERA commander, is going to get many of them back. And what he quickly finds is he can't move ground equipment through all of Europe. Freedom of movement in Europe for civilians, there's an article called the Schengen Agreement, where people don't have to get checked at borders and they can move around within the European Union nations. So what Ben Hodges wanted to create was called a military Schengen, where if you were a EU or a NATO member, you could move tanks and trucks in support of NATO missions across borders. And he made a little bit of headway on that. But what he also found was many of the bridges and roads weren't stressed for AB1 Abrams tanks, and the train tracks couldn't carry Abrams tanks. It's a big issue actually over here, and it's still an issue. And you know, Ben Hodges is retired. He's living in Germany and he's working for a major think tank because he's committed to this, and he's doing everything he can to try and fix it. He's also committed to helping the Ukrainians in the war. But that's just one more example of, you know, and the reason I bring that up is the example is, and as an Air Force guy, I'll take a little bit of hit. You know, we said, we'll just be able to fly things everywhere. We'll just keep building more rotary wing. We'll build more C-17s and we'll fly everything. We don't need to move things across the land. And that's just not true.
I'm glad you raised that point. You know, I wanted to ask you, when we talk about EMS superiority, oftentimes the conversation goes right to offensive electronic warfare, jamming operations and so forth. But, you know, when you're trying to project, achieve, or sustain EMS superiority, there's a lot more that goes into it. We talk about it being across .mil PF, you know, not just operations, but doctrine and leadership. And of course, you raised the issue of logistics is a huge piece.
Yeah, I think I know what you're getting at. And it's interesting. I was interviewing or talking to a Ukrainian soldier that had just come back from the front of the war, I want to say about 2 months ago. And I asked him, I said, hey, you know, how hard is it to talk on the radios? How bad is the jamming, right? How effective is it for shutting down your comms? And his answer was, we can't talk to anybody. Everything is getting jammed. And I said, oh, okay, well, do you know who from your, because you guys have jammers too, who from your side is making sure that they're not jamming your frequencies? And how do you know that the Russians are the ones jamming you? Or how do you not know that you've set up your antennas on two different sides of a hill and you just don't have a line of sight? You know, he's not a radio guy. He's not an EW guy. He's an infantry guy, and God bless him. He didn't know the answer to that. So, you know, I often complained back in the day when I was an EW staff officer that, you know, we need to have a joint restricted frequency list and it's got to be tight and we can't be jamming each other. And, you know, and there'd always be mistakes, right? There'd always be fog of war and there'd always be a few mistakes, but probably nothing on the level of what the Ukrainians are seeing. And I guess we actually, compared to Ukraine, we probably did a pretty effective job. When you talk about MISO and you talk about, you know, combined effects in the battle space, I really like the idea where AOC is going when they talk about cohesive and combined effects, because it's important. But I pray to God that as we're talking about that, we're doing exactly what you just brought up, and that is combined effects in the battle space to include logistics, medical, things like that. How does EW support those? We're learning that EW does support them in Ukraine, because without electronic spectrum superiority, there's more guys dying, sadly, in Ukraine, because they have to take roads back to get medical care, and some of them just aren't making it.
Last question, you know, to kind of pull away a little bit from the topic here at hand, you mentioned it early on in the episode, you're writing a new book, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit more about that. You're a military fiction author. You have some great books out there. Highly encourage our listeners to pick them up and take a read, but you're working on a new one that's actually very relevant. Could you tell us a little bit more about that and where that's going?
Sure. Yeah. And I appreciate the question. So my first book's out. It's been out for about a year. It's called Live Range. It's about a Navy SEAL that it all focuses around him and his friends basically getting out and trying to do some good in the world as opposed to doing bad. My second book, called Balkan Reprisal, will be out. It'll be released October 11th. And on this book, I focused heavily on leveraging my electronic warfare history. So you're going to see Compass Call being operationally used in the war. You're going to see Commando Solo doing PSYOPs. You're going to see information operations. You're going to see EMP or laser weapons, energy weapons, and many of those types of things in a fictitious war that builds up between Serbia and Kosovo. All the same characters. So if you really want to understand the book, you'd have to read the first one. But book two does stand alone. Book three is called Afghan Ghosts. It was recently approved by the DOD for security. So it's in heavy editing right now. And then book four is called Russian Puppeteers. Like I said, and that's a book about a part of the Ukrainian war. So thanks for the question.
And what is the long-term plan for the release of that? Are we talking next year, 2 years?
No, so my plan is, like I said, Balkan Reprisal will come out October 11th. It'll be available on Amazon starting that day. Anyone who gets the book within the first week is going to get a special edition. After the first week, the special editions will go away. And then Afghan Ghosts will probably be released around January. So both of them will come out in the next. And that's a book basically about the same team going in, and the United States is pulled out of Afghanistan. And it's about that team going in to save some of the Afghans that had helped them while they were assigned and kept them alive, basically, whether they were interpreters or other folks. So that'll come out hopefully early next year. And then mid next year, you'll see book four come out.
That is all the time we have for today. I want to thank my guest, Colonel Fisher, for joining me. It's always great to have you on the show. Hope to have you on again soon. And I will see you probably in a couple months down at the AOC symposium here in Washington, D.C. So looking forward to catching up with you in person. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, Ken, thank you so much. I truly do appreciate it. It's always great to talk to you. And the AOC listeners are, I love to death, because, you know, their knowledge of EW is something that you don't find in the average crowd. I do look forward to seeing you at the AOC convention. And if anyone does buy my book and they find me, feel free to hit me up for a signature. Happy to do it.
That will conclude this episode of From the Crow's Nest. I'd like to thank my guest, retired U.S. Air Force Colonel Jeff Fisher, for joining me. Also, don't forget to review, share, and subscribe to this podcast. We always enjoy hearing from our listeners, so please feel free to take a few moments to share your thoughts and recommendations on the show. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. This podcast is brought to you by Battelle, the world's largest independent, not-for-profit, applied science and technology organization.
Since 1929, their mission has been to translate scientific discovery and technology advances to benefit society. Through markets such as health, environment, infrastructure, industry, and national security, Battelle has been delivering cutting-edge solutions that impact the well-being of the world and help keep us safe at home. To learn more, go to battelle.org/connect. That's BATTELLE.org/connect.